changing the chemical industry is quite complex. It's not an industry where you can avoid a lot of mistakes.
Hi, you're listening to the Gibble podcast. Here, we interview guests that have an inspiring view on our built environment. From waste management, to bio-based materials, to new models of ownership. Gibble is an initiative of Trilux. With a family name that means green in Dutch, it was maybe written in the stars that Joop Groen would occupy himself with the transition towards a bio-based economy. Such as CircuRoad. CircuRoad is a large collaborative project on creating bio-based and circular alternatives for bitumen, the fossil binder of asphalt. Dutch governmental and municipal parties are involved, as well as large road building companies and smaller startups. Joop runs his company called Viride, meaning green in Latin. He says he has an optimistic view on the future.
My background is in chemical engineering and in business administration. I have an MBA, so I always like the combination of technology content, but also how the market works and what customers want, and also the financial economic consequences of does something really work in the market. If we look at the world outside, it's a huge transition that we are in, energy transition, raw materials transition, and these require a lot of changes, a lot of new innovations in processes, in materials, in products. And I think chemical engineering is one of the key competences that can play a very positive role in this transition.
In what ways? Do you have some examples?
If you think about new and innovative processes, for instance, if you look at the petrochemical industry, we have been working more than 100 years in optimizing and shaping that whole industry and those value chains. So that's working pretty well, actually. And if we want to change that to, for instance, bio-based raw materials and use them more, or circular raw materials where we use waste and turn it into a feedstock and use that as a raw material, that requires significantly different processes because you have a different raw material. And if you want to make the same products or maybe even better products, you need a different process to make that conversion. And these processes have a lot to do with chemical processes, with physical processes. So process engineering, chemical engineering can really play a very important role in that. That's also what makes it very interesting.
Yeah. And you're an owner of your own company. And how does these two concepts come together in your company, the business side and the chemical engineering side?
Yeah. So first of all, running my own company, it takes entrepreneurship and it takes a business side to make it viable and to make it healthy. So that's one part. But maybe the more important part is with my background in chemical engineering and a lot of experience in making plastics and marketing plastics, but also working on innovations, I've gained a lot of experience in, you know, how can you approach that and what works and maybe what is very risky or is less likely to succeed, and see that in an early stage.
Yeah, so what do you do? What is it that your company entails?
My company is called Viride. Viride is Latin for green, as in green innovations, but also our family name, Groen, which is Dutch for green. The focus of my company is working on innovations for sustainability and for the whole transition, mainly around raw material transition. If you think about raw material transition, then the focus there is we want to have a better idea than fossil feedstock. So coal, fossil oil, gas, we want to change that into renewable sources. And then the options are quite clear. We have bio-based feedstock. So what nature produces and provides us with, that is a feedstock that is renewable. So it's never ending, let's say. Still, we need to work wisely with it. So if we've seen some examples where bio-based feedstocks are being used and the effects were not as expected or not positive. So it still needs a very conscious and smart approach. So that's one feedstock, bio-based. The other feedstock that we can use is circularity. So everything that we see as waste or that we no longer need is material, is carbon chains. In the end, the whole carbon balance, let's say, is what we end up with that's in a product. We can turn that into new feedstock and new products. And that, of course, also is a very nice concept. Maybe to explain that a little bit more, the traditional economy is fairly linear. We take raw materials, we make products, we use them, and then we throw them away. Either we put them in the ground or we burn them. And in a circular approach, at the end, we turn it back into feedstock or into new products. Third option, theoretically, that you have is using CO2 from the atmosphere or from exhaust systems, using CO2 as a feedstock. So then we turn CO2 emission back into a feedstock and have renewable carbon that way. The challenge there is that it's the technology to do that is still at a very early stage. And there's a lot of energy needed to do that. So maybe in the longer term, that can also play an important role, but it's still a bit unclear and quite difficult.
And do you have an example of a bio-based material that wasn't very successful in its usage?
Yeah, well, one example that sticks out quite clearly is palm oil. Palm oil is positioned as a bio-based feedstock for renewable diesel. So instead of fossil diesel for trucks and cars, you can use bio-based as a diesel replacement. Palm oil is quite an effective way of making renewable diesel that way. So the concept is good, it works, you can make good diesel, the feedstock grows fairly efficient. But then what you see happening if you start asking large quantities in the market, let's say if we change 10% of all our diesel here in Europe to this bio-based, then all of a sudden in the Far East, large quantities of palm oil are being produced, which is of course great for these people, farmers there, they have a business model. But if you cut away forest and replace them for palm oil plantations, then in the end, it does not have an overall positive effect on nature. And that was the initial objective.
Yeah. So you work on different projects and with a lot of different parties. What is your role?
Yeah, in general, my approach and my belief is that collaboration is important. This is quite complex. It's very dynamic. It has to do with value change. It has to do with very fundamental transitions. And that means that it's not something that one company or one organization or one person can really do. It's so complex that you have to work together. But that's also the fun. If you work together, you know, it's nice to do. You can build on each other's ideas. Together, you have so much more intelligence than just one. I always tell companies, also quite large companies, the smartest people, they are not working for you. Even if you are Apple or, you know, doesn't matter who, more smart people are outside of your organization than inside. I grew up in an American multinational. At that time, everything was about competition. Winning, you know, you win, the other loses. We have to be quicker, we have to be smarter, and you have to keep secrets. You know, if you're the only one who knows it, you have a competitive advantage. I think in today's world, that's just not good enough. You can still have a good market and you can still have a competitive position. But at this point, you work together to make progress faster. I think organizations and companies who understand that concept and who successfully manage in combining collaboration with results and competitive advantage, I think they will be more and more the winners of the future.
And do you believe the transition is going fast enough?
Well, I think the transition has to go as fast as it can, but not faster. I don't believe that too fast is very wise. If we look today at, for instance, the Dutch electricity net, then we are forcing that quite risky. So that means electrification is going really fast, maybe faster than it should. So I think we have to be careful of taking unnecessary risks or forcing systems in a way that they will break. The other thing that I think is very important, you also have to balance society in what is important. We can say, well, you know, to make this transition is the top one priority, so let's do that. But we also have to take care of elderly people and the youth, and we have to look at education. We have to look at health. So I think there are more priorities than just this one. So I am not I'm not pessimistic. In the contrary, I'm a very optimistic person. If I look around me, I see a beautiful world. If you go back two generations, you see that, you know, we made a lot of progress. Life is quite good and comfortable. So I don't think that apocalyptic stories about, you know, what's going wrong and that we're all going to hell in a handbasket are helping us very much, especially not for the youth. If you're going to tell the youth that they are easily influenced because they have little experience, little knowledge. So if you're going to tell all the time, oh, it's really going very bad and the future, you have no future at all. And, you know, we're all going to be underwater. I think, first of all, it's not very accurate, because if you look at all predictions and where we are now, well, the predictions were not very accurate. But also, I think such a pessimistic view is not leading us in the right direction. So I think I believe in positive energy and doing the right things. And also, if I look at the youth, then I see smart people. By the time they grow up, they are a lot smarter than I am. And the tools that they work with will be a lot better. If you look at the calculation power that we have today in computers, well, two generations back, there were no computers. So the things that we can do today are incomparable with then. Well, then if you look at two generations down the line, the power will be, again, very different. Maybe they will have a set of new tools that we don't have today, and they will be able to accomplish things around energy, around raw materials, around nature that we cannot envision today. So I'm very optimistic in that way.
Okay. What is your personal motivation to have gone in this path of also your professional career?
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about hobbies. Maybe you notice that I like being outside. So whether it's cycling or skiing or being on the boat or in the garden, I like being outside. And that's close to nature. So I like nature, and I think that is important. So I think we have to, be close to nature in a way, not drift away too far from it, because nature is very old and very wise. And I think we have to be careful with it as well. We should not pollute or damage or, the world around us in ways that are totally not necessary. So that's my motivation. I also don't like throwing things away. So, taking something, using it briefly and then throwing it away, I think should be a better way to use things for a longer period or to reuse it or to repair it. Of course, the best way in a raw material transition is to use less raw materials. At the same time, I think that should be combined with not going around and telling other people what they should do. So I'm very critical about telling other people that they should not fly. Maybe somebody has to fly because of their family reasons or their work or whatever. I don't fly a lot. I have flown when I was global responsible for a product line. I've been flying around the world more than I ever liked. Well, you have to be careful, and it helps if people first look at themselves and then think, okay, what can I do?
Hi, I hope you're enjoying Joop's story. You can read more on Circuit Road and Joop's story on getinspiredbylight.com, an initiative of Trilux. For now, let's continue this podcast show. I would like also to talk about one of the projects you're enrolled in, and that's the Circuit Road project, and it entails bio-based asphalt. First, when I read it, it sounded contradictive, bio-based asphalt. Could you maybe explain a little bit about what it is?
Yeah, well, maybe it's like bio-based plastic, and that's also a reality that might sound contradictive. But if you look at the component in asphalt that makes it black and that makes it stick together and plays a big role in giving it the properties that we need on the road, is bitumen. And bitumen is a fraction of fossil oil. So if you take a barrel of oil that you get out of the ground, a small portion of that in the end turns into bitumen. And if you want to reduce or stop using fossil oil, that means that we also want to stop, and we'll have to stop because it will no longer be there, with fossil bitumen. If you have that ambition, then you need, again, different but also a better way of doing that. If you follow the strategy that I just mentioned around raw material transition, and then the two options, at least for the somewhat shorter term, are using bio-based materials or using circular, using waste and recycle streams for bitumen. Combine that with this idea of collaboration and bringing together intelligence, bringing together facilities, bringing together financial resources, but also the ability to take risk. There we created the Circuit Road collaboration. It's a big collaboration with the players around the value chain for making roads. If you look at the value chain for making a road, most important players are the ones owning the road. We have a good number of these road authorities in the collaboration. Rijkswaterstaat is the biggest supporter, is also the biggest single road owner, but also the biggest supporter, very active and very supportive in Circuit Road. Then if we move in the value chain upstream, then we have the companies that are actually building the roads. Of course, they are very important because They know about building roads. They understand asphalt. They know about bitumen like Boskalis or Asphalt New or KWS. We also have some smaller road builders that can be very innovative. Sometimes large companies can be a little bit like very big ships, like tankers. They're a bit slow. They're very large and they're very strong, but they're also not easily changed in direction. And smaller companies can be speedboats that can make quicker moves. So they're also very useful. So we have smaller road builders also in that collaboration. Then we have parties who actually make and blend the bitumen. And we have raw material suppliers. But also in the collaboration, we have knowledge parties. So universities and research and technology organizations. So yeah, this collaboration, we started it in 2019 and it really works quite well. It has been growing because others see, hey, there's a good initiative. This is the way we want to work. So we join it.
Yeah. And what would be the replacement material for the bitumen?
We are working hard on that. So there are a number of options. We don't have the final, 100% solution yet. So that's a process of working on it. At this moment, we look at the combination of bio-based feedstock and also circular feedstock. For the, let's say, the fairly short term, we want to, make impact and have products that are being used. There are a number of side products, for instance, from papermaking industry. So if you look at the papermaking industry, there the raw material is wood. You use wood, you make paper. But in the wood, in the tree, there are a couple of other products like tall oil or like lignin. There are various sorts of rubbers in nature. So there are a number of these bio-based feedstocks. There are a number of vegetable oils that could be interesting, especially if they are not for food. So we don't have that food competition. The good thing with bitumen is the quantity of bitumen that we need compared to, for instance, fuel is fairly small. We need about 70 kilotons of bitumen for the Dutch asphalt market. I used to be a plant manager here, and in the plant, one plant for plastic makes around 70 kilotons. That's a fairly, let's say, modest amount that you need from nature. I think in that way, you can look a little bit at this transition. For the really, really large amounts that you need, for instance, fuel for cars, diesel, gasoline, kerosene together, they represent a huge amount of the fossil fuel. If you would turn all of that to bio-based, that would be risky because you start harvesting too much. For bitumen, it's quite okay. The 70 kilotons, we can find it in a sustainable way and make sure that it's used very well. If you look at the circular streams, there are also some very interesting candidates. That market is changing very fast. So there's a lot of innovation. There are a lot of initiatives happening in increasing circularity. That transition is a bit newer compared to, for instance, the energy transition. If we think about windmills and solar panels and even geothermal energy, that's already very well developed. You see that everywhere around us. New wind parks can even be realized without subsidy. So it's a fully commercial competitive model against alternatives. For the raw material transition, that's at an earlier stage. It may be 15 or 20 years later. That means that a lot is happening. And we are looking at all these dynamics and seeing, well, what are the opportunities coming out of these dynamics for bitumen? So we can use maybe, if you think about plastics, that nowadays a lot of it we throw away or we keep it in a separate bag, but it's still burnt, or maybe sometimes it's pressed in some parts that are not really plastic parts. It's just some, poles or whatever thick parts that we make out of this recycled plastic that you could utilize in a much smarter way to make new plastic that is as good as virgin plastic. So you can make your laptop out of it, or a microphone, or a display. There will be side streams coming out of that. And maybe some of these side streams are also suitable to make bitumen.
Yeah. And would they also have the same properties as well? Or is that difficult to experiment with?
Well, I think the trick with innovation is always, you should not just put as a target, I want to make the same as what I am replacing. For instance, I've been working a lot on plastics. Producing plastics, designing plastics, making parts out of plastics. A lot of times we were working with customers that were used to steel. Let's say an automotive producer was used to making a steel fender on his car. And then we said, well, if you make it in plastic, it's lighter, you can produce it faster, it can have a much more appealing design than the steel. And in the end, the part can be cheaper. But what we did not do is, well, tried to make exactly the same part as in steel. We redesigned it to make it suitable for plastic so you can make use of all the benefits. I think in this transition, we should look at it the same way. We do not necessarily have to make exactly the same, but think about, okay, what is in the end the product we want to make and make sure it works well. What we do in specifically for asphalt, what is important, a lot of the asphalt in the Dutch roads is being reused. The layers are grounded and reused again. That's very positive because it's a circular way of reusing your product as a new feedstock. So we think that is important. That has to stay. That means our new solution has to be compatible. You have to be able to mix it with this reused asphalt. So that is an important objective, to make sure it's compatible with traditional fossil bitumen, because that will still be around for tens, maybe hundreds of years. Then the properties should be equal or better. With this innovation, we can make a better bitumen. Well, that would, of course, be positive. Then the cost is also quite important, because in the end, you know, we should avoid that everything becomes more expensive. And we have seen with the energy policy over the last years that if you forget cost competitiveness, that for society, that really can create some serious problems. As you can see today, if you go to the voedselbanken or if you look at poverty levels in society. So that's not something that we should try to underestimate.
Yeah, so there's 25 batches of asphalt being produced or tested. And what are the first results?
Yeah, there are 25 test strips, most of them with various combinations of bio-based raw materials. None of them are just 100% replacement, but partly up to maximum 50% at this moment. The oldest one was actually produced in 2015 by roadbuilder H4A in Zeeland. They put a test strip right in front of their own asphalt plant. From what I heard, that still looks fairly good. So that was certainly not a bad start. We worked a lot on this concept to get to 50% replacement level. But then we also saw, well, this is the maximum in this way that you can do. Then we defined a next generation project to say, well, our ambition is to make 100% replacement of the fossil bitumen as a raw material. We noticed that takes a different approach in terms of composition, raw materials, and technology to make the asphalt. So you can say we're building on top of the experience that has been gained and making the next steps.
Okay. When looking ahead, what is one of the major goals of this project?
Yeah, so in the end, the major goal of this project is to make the new standard for asphalt in a way that it's 100% replacement of fossil bitumen. So no longer new fossil raw materials would be needed to produce asphalt and to produce roads. In that way, we want to make sure that it's using a feedstock that is sustainable. We expect that it will be a mix of bio-based raw materials, potentially combined with circular raw materials. And quite important that it's also a cost-effective solution.
Yeah, and what is the role of policymakers in this enterprise?
First of all, the policymakers, or let's say the government, play in the Silk Road collaboration an extra special role because they also own the roads. If you think about the raw material transition for plastics, there the government makes policy, but they don't own the market or they don't own the products. Or here they really literally own and take care and specify the products, the roads. So that's the very important role. It's not only about making policies, which can help a lot, or can also slow down, by the way. Policy, and it's quite difficult to make good policy. So in some initiatives, you see that policy is slowing down innovation, and sometimes for good reasons. So here, it's really also specifying and buying and setting the direction. In the Silk Road Initiative, we talk a lot about the technology development, but also the market development, and that should go hand in hand. If we develop a new product, the market should also develop in accepting that product. And if the market is not there or is not developing, then it doesn't make sense to even develop the product, because in the end, it will be just another product without a market. Whether it's a municipality, whether it's a province or the national road authorities, these are all governments that can really make or break the success of this transition.
Yeah. And when looking abroad, do you see other initiatives on this topic that are ahead of their time?
In the Circle Road project, we have a specific work package that's focusing on, we call it the state of the art, making sure that we understand at a global scale who's doing what, what's happening specifically for this bio-based and circular asphalt. Because of that work, we have a pretty good view on what's happening everywhere. And there's certainly some very interesting developments happening across the borders as well. There is a global bio-based bitumen collaboration. It's very new. It's still kind of being formed. Yeah, we are part of that and talking to the international players in this field. I think that that's really important in the one hand to share what we are doing so they can benefit from that. On the other hand, also to learn what's happening over there to see how we can learn from that and move forward quicker.
Yeah, I wanted to come back to what we talked about earlier. You're a business owner. You've been working in this field for quite a while. Is there one important lesson you've learned?
Oh, so many. I think some are maybe a bit philosophical, but I think that the one that I just mentioned, keeping the difference of, you know, policy or story making or facts and science, keep that clean and keep that separate. Also, don't mix it up and don't just listen to a story you heard and start repeating that and running after that. So make sure that you understand really the facts. Maybe we all remember the image of a polar bear on a piece of ice and how sorry that was because his ice was disappearing and the polar bears were disappearing. The facts at that point and still are, there are more polar bears than ever. They don't need a piece of ice to sit on it because they live in the water and they're very comfortable underwater hunting and eating and living. So, you know, that's making drama instead of helping everybody move forward. So I think that is really important. Balance objectives that we have, like changing the raw materials in a good way. Einstein once said, you have to make everything as simple as possible, but not more simple than that. In other words, if you oversimplify, some things can really go wrong. Changing the chemical industry is quite complex. It's not an industry where you can avoid a lot of mistakes. It's something you have to be careful with. If you build a new process, a new plant, like the plants that we see here outside, production plants, if you do something wrong there, well, you know, it can explode. So you want to make sure that you really do things thoroughly and you do it right. So yeah, I think some lessons.
Are these things you've also learned by experiencing them yourself, by making mistakes?
Yeah, a lot of them. Painfully so. I'm afraid, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And when looking at the future, you said before you're a very optimistic person. What are you most optimistic about?
But I'm optimistic, I think, about the people of the future. We're constantly learning, we're getting better tools, we're getting smarter. Yeah, I would never tell a negative story to the youth about you will have problems later. I think you will have, you know, a great future. We'll be very smart people. That's why I also think that educating is very important. It's one of the smartest things we can do is probably educate the new generation because they will be so smart that they will be able to do our work even a lot better. Yeah, so that's I'm optimistic about a lot of these things.
Well, that's a good way to finish. Thank you very much. Thanks for this conversation.
You're welcome. Thanks
very
for the interview.
Thanks. This was the Gibbel Podcast with Joop Groen. Read more about his thoughts on the bio-based economy on getinspiredbylight.com. In the next episode, I speak with Elisa Pals, climate psychologist and founder of Zero Waste NL.
Our behavior is very, very much socially driven, but still when we want to change people's behavior, we focus on individual reasons. And that doesn't make sense.
Get Inspired by Light is an initiative of Trilux.